This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my amazing and curious friends. My name is Jennifer, and this is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek inside the real world of scientists, engineers, and experts as they solve problems in their jobs using creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. And now please welcome to the show my podcast partner, Galactic Space Geek, Jeff Gagne.
Hello, Jennifer, and hello, listeners. And I have to tell you, we may just have the coolest episode we have ever had.
I think you're giving us another hint, Jeff. What is the episode about today?
How are glaciers nature's time machines?
How are glaciers nature's time machine? This sounds very cool. Who is our guest today, Jeff?
Our guest today is the absolutely awesome Dr. Uliana Horodisky, and she is, get this, a glaciologist, geologist, and a visiting professor of environmental science at Colorado College.
This is so exciting. Welcome to the show, Dr. Uli.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm actually at the college right now speaking to you guys.
That's awesome. So you can wave to Jeff then, right?
Yes. Yeah, across the way there.
So I have to ask, why glaciers, which I think are cool, and you're going to hear us say that a lot, but for a different reason.
It really started for me as a kid. So my parents really believed in, yeah, in experiential learning, not just like reading books, which I did a lot of as a kid, but like really putting us out into nature. So I was only 6 years old when I had my first experience in the mountains in Switzerland.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, wow.
Real mountains too.
Oh, yeah, big ones.
But I know a lot of people live in places that have little baby hills. They call them mountains.
I wasn't climbing yet at 6 years old, but they had this really cool railway that went up to about 10,000 feet. And then we got out, my two brothers and me and my parents, and it's snowing in July. Of course, we're running around grabbing snowballs, throwing them at each other, just having a blast up there. And then in the distance, we heard like this big roar, like something collapsing. We're like, what is that? And we look behind and like all this ice had come down in an avalanche. I didn't know what that meant as a six-year-old. What is that?
Okay.
Well, I was just like, wow, look at that. And I think that's kind of how I started getting interested in the natural world. There's just kind of this imprinting of like, wow, raw power of Mother Nature.
Yes.
I want to understand. I want to understand what are these things, you know? And then especially now in a time when everything's changing with the climate, you know, and things are warming up. We're losing the ice. We're losing the stories that they hold.
Yes.
So one thing that you just said right there at the end, we're losing the stories that they tell.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So when you think about it, how does a glacier start? It starts with snowflakes, right? And enough of them fall, they compress into ice. And enough of them, when we're talking about like miles thick ice in like the polar regions and other places, give it enough millions of years time to build.
That's hard to comprehend.
It is. It really is. Like when you think about like how tall that is, I was just in Central Park in New York City. There's actual evidence for past glaciers reaching all the way to New York City. And if you looked up, it would be like as high as some of those skyscrapers. Like it just blows my mind.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, imagine each one of those layers has a little story of what the weather was doing at the time. If you've ever seen tree rings,
they're really
thin sometimes. And when they're really thin, that means there wasn't enough water to grow. And when they're thicker, there was. So for a glacier, it's the same thing. When you have really thin layers, there wasn't that much snow falling. But then when you have thicker layers, then you had a lot more snow. And so you can actually look back in time through all those different layers to see if it was like a warm period or a cold period based on how much snow fell.
Wow. Okay. So how do you tell the layers apart? Because me, I'd look at ice and I go, oh, it's just ice, right? I mean, I can see the layers of rock and of course, like the Grand Canyon. Yeah. Does a glacier look like that too?
So it's a lot more subtle. What scientists do is they drill these tubes, and they kind of like, if you think about putting a straw into something, imagine that straw is a tube, and you go in and you get a sample. So scientists do that on a large scale to collect ice. And so they're kind of like 3 feet long sections at a time, because otherwise they break apart.
Right. Okay.
And then they get cut in half, and you can look with a special light, and you can actually see, real subtle differences between the layers.
You mean cut in half lengthwise?
Correct. Yes.
So it's like cutting down the long way of the straw.
Yes.
Exactly. Okay. So you can see the whole inside of that core.
Yeah. Wow. And sometimes there's not just ice there, but sometimes you'll see like random thick layers of dark stuff. You're like, what is that? It could be volcanic ash. So, there's a really like famous ice core from Antarctica. It's one of the longest ice cores in the world. Like it took like 5 years to pull out all the sections.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. But they did it. And so you can look back in time, hundreds of thousands of years as a result. And they noticed some of these thicker layers and like, what is this stuff? And then they were actually able to look back in time at when volcanoes erupted in Antarctica and match it with chemistry to those volcanoes, which is pretty wild.
This is like natural storytelling.
Absolutely.
How you're linking these things together.
Exactly. And you know the really cool thing? So cores have been pulled from Mount Everest. And from Mount Everest, really hard work.
Wow.
You can imagine, right? Back in 1986, the year I was born, was a really famous nuclear accident that happened in Ukraine called Chernobyl.
Okay. Yep.
And they actually can detect radioactivity in ice cores, and they found it in the Everest core. They did some chemistry. Yeah.
That I actually knew that they were able to detect the radiation, but I didn't know about being able to go that deep into Antarctica. So do these different layers, I'd like to visualize this. Are they different colors? Like, how do you tell one layer from another?
Yeah, they're really subtle in their color differences. And it's kind of also tied to their texture, because every summer there's a bit of melting that happens, and it kind of leaves a signal in the texture before the next snow falls and creates a fresher layer. So if you use a special light against it, you can see kind of those subtle, it's like cloudier versus clearer. You can think of it that way.
Okay.
That is so cool.
Yes. So I heard you say earlier that you can tell colder periods of time in the past versus warmer, because colder would have more snow and a thicker layer, warmer, obviously a thinner layer inside those cores. What else, what other information can you pull out of those cores? Mm. Is it just temperature?
Temperature is a big one, but also you can tell past levels of these, what's called greenhouse gases. Mm-hmm. Greenhouse gases are kind of like, you know, when you put a blanket on when you're sleeping. Greenhouse gases are like a blanket for the planet. They serve a good purpose, but too much of it and it gets too hot. You want to throw off the blanket.
Understand. Yes.
So there's actual bubbles in the ice that trapped gas in it. And very carefully, using all this like laboratory equipment, you can actually pull and extract that air and try to get
out of the little bubble.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And then you do what? Test it to see what it's made of or what's in it?
Exactly. So you do something called measuring these things called isotopes, just a word in chemistry of like, you can tell basically what it is. Is it made of carbon? Is there hydrogen in it? And all of them do tell a story that the scientists use some math to tell us not only how much of those different elements or gases were present, but then the temperature. So ice core doesn't tell us temperature directly, right?
Okay.
We have to kind of infer, we have to guess what that temperature is, but we get pretty good at guessing because the math is really good.
Well, that's amazing. So can you tell us a little bit about what you're working on now, and or, you know, because I know that you mentioned climate change and whatever. So does your work, do you do stuff with climate change to see what's happening? Or
I'm actually right in the middle of trying to publish a new paper. So this publication in a scientific journal on what's happening actually on the north side of Mount Everest. There's a lot of information on the south side where it's just easier access, easier in quotes here, because it's not easy.
Is that the side that people climb on, the south side?
They climb Everest from both sides, but most, go from the south. It's just an easier kind of summit day from the south. But there's a lot of information from the south, Mount Everest, but what about the north, which is known as kind of that rain shadow, the drier side of the mountain.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. What's happening there? Like, what's climate change? Is climate change affecting it more, less? What's going on? So this new paper I'm writing is about research from what's called ground truth. Ground truth is the best because you get to actually go out into the field outside and take measurements and not just use Google Earth. Google Earth is great for lots of things, but me, I'm also a mountaineer, meaning I climb mountains. I love to be out there and collecting data.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So have you visited the north side of Everest? Are you starting to collect data from there?
So all the data from there was collected about a decade before me, before I went actually to Nepal on the south side.
Okay.
Let me tell you, getting access on the north side was very tricky, and then the pandemic. So forget it right now.
Okay.
But there's still hope in the future to go and verify some of these results. So ground truth is someone else had already done, plus all the stuff I had to use Google Earth. And then, eventually we'll confirm some of those measurements as well. But that's kind of the next phase. Scientists kind of publish things in phases, right? Once they start to find information, they'll publish it.
Yes.
Then other scientists kind of contribute, say, well, look, I found this. What about this? And that's how science works. Pretty cool.
Yes, exactly. So can you talk a little bit about the ice in the Arctic and the Antarctic? Because we hear a lot about that in the news. And not that you don't believe everything, but I don't think that they actually can tell us, like, you don't always hear the truth of how big a deal this might be.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing is, the Arctic and Antarctic, right? So the Arctic is ocean surrounded by land. Mm-hmm. And Antarctica is land with a huge mass of ice on it, surrounded by ocean. So they behave differently, but they still kind of tell the same story that climate change is affecting the ice. So let's start in the north. So in the north, you have a lot of glaciers that form, for example, in Greenland, you know, these big ice masses.
Yes.
Greenland is melting really quickly. Now, the interesting thing about the Arctic is not only are there these big masses of ice in places like Greenland, there's a lot of what's called sea ice. This is ice mm-hmm. that creates out of the ocean. It's when the ocean freezes. You've probably seen like lakes freeze, right? So
right.
The ocean does too. It gets cold enough. Now, because the atmosphere is getting so warm and the ocean, that sea ice is not in a good place because it's getting heat from both ends, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so sea ice is a natural reflector, like a mirror, which reflects away solar radiation, which keeps the Arctic cool. When you start to remove that mirror, right, you remove that mirror and you're left behind with this dark ocean water that actually absorbs more of the sun's radiation.
Oh.
I liken it to, like, imagine you're wearing a t-shirt outside. And it's dark versus light colored, right? So if you wear a light t-shirt on a hot day, you're cool. If you wear a dark t-shirt, you're really warm.
You're really hot.
Exactly. So the ocean and the ice does the same thing. The ice is like that white t-shirt and the ocean's like that black t-shirt, that dark t-shirt. So once you get rid of that sea ice, you're warming that ocean up. You're absorbing solar radiation. It's causing that ice to melt pretty rapidly in the Arctic. Now, in Antarctica, you also have ocean warming up, but you have this huge mass of ice that's still kind of keeping Antarctica cooler than the north, right?
Okay.
So that's good. So climate change is affecting Antarctica because of the ocean warming, but it's a lot slower than the Arctic just because it has this miles thick ice sheet that's kind of protecting it still.
Oh.
So we are, as scientists, looking more in the Arctic for changes that are going to happen pretty rapidly because it's we're already seeing
it. Jeez.
Mm-hmm.
When I hear all of the information you were just saying, it sounds so, you know, you're talking about all of the ice, you're talking about all of Antarctica,
mm-hmm.
you're talking about all of the ice that we can see, like the kids see in a classroom on a globe, like mm-hmm. you were talking about all of that ice that we can see. Is this something that all human beings should be getting information on?
Absolutely. I mean, this is critical. And the reason why is because all that ice, if it ends up in the ocean, is going to melt. And then what happens?
Mm.
We're going to have the sea levels rising, affecting our coasts where people live. Where are those people going to go? So we absolutely need to have good information. And to have a visual of this, let's imagine a glass of water, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's already filled up with water
mm-hmm.
and it already has ice in it. When that ice melts, does the water level change? No, because it's already in there. That's like sea ice, right?
Okay.
Maybe a little bit by expansion. But now imagine land-based ice, like from Greenland, and add ice cubes to that water. You will see that water level rise.
So that's what I'm talking about.
Land-based ice going into the ocean is going to cause sea level rise. No question about it. You can do that experiment at home and see it for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Now, see, that's the part that I didn't completely understand, that the land-based ice is what the big problem is.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess the next question is what can we do about this to prevent it? Because, and I know that's a huge question to ask. But as a glaciologist, what do you see happening, or what would you like to see happening?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, like, the problem is so big that it's frightening. So it becomes like, well, we can't do anything, so let's not do anything. And then the problem gets worse. So what can we do on the small scale? There's many things, you know, thinking about just in your homes, for example, do we need so much heating or air conditioning? Do we need to drive, or can we walk? Can we be healthy and walk or ride a bicycle places? Can we recycle? Can we not reuse single-use plastics? You know, those plastic bags from the grocery store. Everyone doing this adds up, right? And so the big problem here is this warming, and it comes from all our uses of convenient life. Like, we love, you know, our TVs, and we love, you know, I'm not saying we have to stop that, but there's ways to manage it, and there's ways to do what you can. Simple little things, like in our, where we live in this condo, we noticed, this really cold downstairs, but the upstairs is really hot, and we're using all this energy. That's a waste. So we can seal, you know, the doors with some of this plastic, or line, sorry, not plastic, with tape. We can line our doors and our windows with that. And then we notice this big difference. So all the heat wasn't just escaping. So little things like that, that you can do, look around your home. Lights is a big one, right? Just leaving lights on randomly.
Yes, all turn that, them off.
Not only do you save your parents money by turning them off, you're helping to save the planet. Yes.
Okay. So, asked and answered that big question. So I want to bring this back to the science of glaciology that you do, because I think a lot of people, if not all people, have kind of heard this story that we were just telling, that ice is melting. It is a global problem. There are lots of little things that we can do, even if we don't think, until we multiply by the numbers of people that can make these changes, that it will help. As a glaciologist, what are you going to do in the future? Is it more of the same, or is there more or different science that's coming studying the ice here on Earth?
That's a great question. One of the things I think scientists can do more of is communicating the findings in easier ways to understand.
Oh, okay.
I call that the art of science storytelling, right?
There you go.
Like, honestly, who really responds to a graph, right? When you see it, you're like, what?
Sure.
But if you see an image, or you see, like, I did a lot of time-lapse photography watching glaciers changing in the Himalayas.
Okay.
Like, wow, that's very powerful visual. And if you also tell stories, if you pitch it as, like, this is the story of the ice is telling us the story, or the people who live amongst the ice, who live very close by to it, who rely on it when it melts for drinking water. Let's hear their stories. Because I think once you have a human connection, that's what changes minds and changes hearts.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, so now I'm going to go back to the technical thing. So when you do the core sample, do you use like a piece of metal, like a pipe? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, so it's a drill. It's a drill that gets used, and I have to drill down. I mean, this...
But it's a pipe that you're drilling, right?
Correct.
So you're... And how far down does this go?
Yeah, so typically each core comes out as a section of about 3 feet. So they kind of go down, and they get the first 3 feet, and they go down further and get the next 3 feet. So you can imagine, if you're talking about a mile, why it takes so long.
And then
I didn't know they had drills so long.
Yeah, and here's a funny story. Okay, so imagine you're in Antarctica, and you're a scientist, and you're drilling for these ice cores. And you bring one up that's probably like a few hundred feet down, maybe let's say 1,000 feet down. And you bring a section up. The ice shatters because it's too warm.
I was going to ask that.
It's too warm in Antarctica, which is probably minus 20 at the time that they're sampling. So they actually had to build a refrigerator, or a freezer rather.
Wait, what? They built a freezer on Antarctica?
Yep. Where they were drilling, they built a freezer so that the samples of ice could slowly start to what's called equilibrate, become equal with the atmosphere, so that the change in pressure didn't cause them to shatter. So imagine, like, this is just the funniest thing. You go down to Antarctica to sample ice and you have to build a freezer.
That's what my question was going to be. When you bring them up, I was like, do they melt instantly. Mm-hmm. And then I assume that they're keep them in the freezer to keep them as frozen as possible. And then they're all identified. So, you know, where it was and all these.
Yes. Here's the thing. You have to label top and bottom, because if you don't, then you don't know where you are in time. So all the cores and where they get packaged up specially and they get labeled. Now it is, you could imagine it's quite the journey. The National Ice Core Lab actually is here in Colorado, about an hour from Colorado Springs. So in fact, in my class, we visited the Ice Core Lab. You can go into a freezer that's minus 40 and check it out very quickly. What? It only can last like a couple minutes.
Do they provide parkas for this?
Yes.
The Florida girl would be a little cold. I mean, I would like to see this, but
does your class take visitors? I want to go in.
Yeah, for sure. Be in touch, because yeah, the tours are actually open to the public too, because they want you to see like, this is where our stories of climate change are coming from. But you can imagine the ordeal of getting the ice from Antarctica to Colorado. So first it goes either on a plane or on a ship, and it's kept in these freezers. And then it goes on the back of a truck once it reaches the US mainland. And then you just really hope that those freezers keep up. I remember hearing a story from the Ice Core Lab that one of the deliveries was one of the hottest days, just by timing and coincidence.
Oh, no.
And they're like scrambling to get those samples into the freezers at the site, at the lab.
Oh my gosh.
What is the oldest ice that you have seen and looked at?
Personally, out in the field, just a few thousand years. Like there's a Kilimanjaro, can just touch the ice. Yeah, now, when we're talking geology, we're talking about billions of years. So yes, just in quotes for geologic time. But here's the cool thing. At that Ice Core Lab, I asked if I could hold one of the pieces of the famous Vostok Ice Core, the one that went back over a million years. And they gave me a piece saying, don't drop it. It was all wrapped. You know, it was wrapped.
Okay.
But I'm holding it. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this piece is like 400,000 years old. It's unbelievable. Like,
wow.
What was going on in time then? Like just, it blows the mind to think about what the land looked like that many years ago, and just trying to envision. And then that ice, where it came from, that's the thing that I'm talking about, connecting with nature and the planet.
And what you just said of thinking about what the land looked like, I have visited Central Park in New York City, and I did not see it with the same eyes you did. And I am super jealous right now. So when you drive around, and you live in Colorado, when you drive around, do you see the world differently because you know where Earth has been changed because of glaciers?
Great question. And the answer is yes. You know, anytime you take me even to a modern place like New York, instead of taking a look around the park and enjoying and looking at the skyscrapers, I'm like, where's the rocks? Where are the rocks? Or look. And I was telling my husband, like, do you see those streaks there? That's where the glacier like dragged rocks across. It's like, wow. Like, so yeah, my eye is always like tuned in to like what stories there are. I can't help it. Like, it's just something I've been doing since being a kid, even before going to school for all this stuff. It's just something I just always had, this natural curiosity.
So what do you look for in the rocks? So when you pick up the rocks, are you physically looking for streaks like this? Or like, what do you look for?
Yeah, so you kind of look both ways, large scale and small scale. So large scale, if you could see the streaks, you're like, oh, cool. And then when you look at the small scale, you try to see like, how far are the grooves in? What does that say about how heavy the ice may have been, or how big of a rock did it drag? But honestly, so when my husband and I are climbing, because we're also rock climbers, there's these beautiful formations called the Flatirons near Boulder that used to be flat-lying, and then they got lifted up millions of years ago when the Rockies were being formed. All that used to be like ocean floor. They got pushed up. And so I'm like looking as I'm climbing, and then I see like these beautiful quartz crystals, which people are like, oh, great. This is a great handhold for climbing. I'm also looking at, well, how did this get here? How did this form? You know, so I'm not even thinking about like from the perspective of a climber, but also like, wow, how old is this crystal or something? So
right. So some of your climbs take a little bit longer because you're studying on the way up.
And my climbs end up heavier at the end because I'm also scoping out rocks. Oh, I wish I had it. But this was one of my best finds in the mountains last summer. We were climbing a place that we did not really climb that often because it's a 13,000 foot peak. And most people like to climb the 14ers, the 14,000.
Sure.
Right.
So the 13ers don't get as much traffic. And so we're walking up this really steep slope. And then I'm noticing something glistening in the sunlight. And I walk over, and it's this geode. A geode is basically this rock that cracks open, and it has all these beautiful crystals.
Okay.
It was probably about 5 or 6 pounds. And wow. Unfortunately,
that's big for a geode.
And unfortunately, I found it at the start of the climb, meaning I had to climb all the way up
and
all
down.
The way down.
You are a dedicated rock hound, so to speak, there, I would say. Yeah.
Yep.
But geodes are very, very amazing and very cool. And yeah, you can learn so much about rocks. In fact, I did a book on rocks, which is really fun for kids to go out like you, get outside and dig their own rocks and then do all these kinds of things with them. Rocks are, they're amazing. They're pieces of history, right?
Yeah.
My 10-year-old daughter loves that book.
Nice. Yeah, you never know what you're going to find. That's the beauty of it. It's like lots of things around the world have been figured out, right? Google Earth doesn't leave that many surprises anymore. You can explore. But then when you actually get your feet on the ground and exploring and digging around, one of the coolest things I found also, this was during a college class, was we went to an area known for fossils that were like 250 million years ago. It's like, how do you even fathom that amount of time?
Yes.
But I'm cracking open this rock and I see this little critter called a trilobite. And I'm like, wow, this thing. Yeah, a trilobite that has not seen the light of day in then how many millions of years. And I just found one. That was cool.
In a rock.
Yeah, in a layer of rock.
Not just out in the open, in a rock.
Exactly, in a layer of rock that it kind of poked out and opened. And there was the mold of it. I'm like, wow.
Yep, those are amazing.
So I want to bring what you do right back to all of us. Because I live here in Colorado and there is a ton of rocks everywhere. And I love this state. Now I am really going to be paying attention, better attention everywhere I go. If I see scratches or marks in a rock, is there any way that I can tell, not being a glaciologist, that they were caused by glaciers? Do they have to be going like north-south?
Great question. And no, they don't. One of the other pieces of evidence you can look for is glaciers are kind of also known as nature's bulldozers. So when they're flowing down a mountain valley, they're taking all the rocks with them, big rocks, small rocks, pulverizing them, kind of crushing them all and moving them down.
Yeah.
So if you take a look around, say you see streaks and you take a look around and you see all these kind of mixed rocks of different sizes, that's a clue to you that this is glacial terrain. So again, think bulldozer, think mixed rocks. And if you see that, it's a pretty good chance.
Never learned that before. Thank you.
Yeah, that's fabulous. Well, we've come to the part in the show where we ask you, if you have a challenge for our listeners, I'm very excited to hear what your challenge will be.
And this one is a very delicious challenge.
Ooh,
all right.
Ooh.
So we talked about ice cores, right? We don't know what's in the core until we pull it out. And we can't like image an entire glacier or cut an entire glacier.
Right,
like that,
right.
We have to rely on these clues from these cores. So the delicious challenge is to have an adult help you to bake some cupcakes.
Okay.
Sounds good so far.
Yeah. We're in.
But it can't be just a single flavor. So it gets even better. So if you like chocolate and vanilla, you can have both, right? So you'll have to make these layers in your cupcakes with the batter.
Okay.
And you can throw in chocolate chips. You can throw in, I love Pop Rocks. Yeah. That's kind of a funny thing. I love Pop Rocks.
Marshmallows.
So you bake this all into a cupcake and then you slather it with this frosting on top, white frosting that's going to be the top of your glacier.
Okay.
And then you take a straw and you put it in and you take a core. So the lighter layers are your ice. The darker layers might be a volcanic eruption or some kind of dust, a dust storm that came from the desert. You have to kind of come up with your own story from your core. And you can take cores from different locations, multiple straws, and see, is it thicker in one location or not, these darker layers? And then when you're done with the entire thing, you cut the cupcake in half, and then you see if you were right or not about what you think happened, and then you eat it.
That is awesome!
But make sure you do that step before. You got to cut it open and use it for science first.
Take pictures.
Exactly.
Take your data, write it down like a good scientist.
I love it, Dr. Uli. This might be the sweetest challenge we've gotten yet.
Absolutely. Well, this has been a fabulous chat. I'm so excited to have learned all about glaciers. This was so much fun. Thank you for being on Solve It for Kids, Dr. Uli.
Thank you, Dr. Uli.
Thank you.
Wow, Dr. Uli really is one of the coolest people I have ever met. And the passion that she has for her job and doing that time travel through the ice. What do you think, Jen?
This was just awesome. And I know we keep saying the word cool, which we say normally, but I mean, when you think about taking a core sample that is as long as she was describing, I mean, holy cow, you can go so far back in time right here on Earth. I just think that's amazing.
And the amount of different things that they can learn. I had no idea that there were bubbles of atmosphere trapped in the ice. We've all seen bubbles in ice before. Never thought about it like a scientist that I could extract information from that. And that's just what she's doing. Now, how about this super fun activity challenge she has for us? This may be the most popular challenge we have ever had, because who's not gonna want to bake cupcakes and take core samples out of the cupcakes?
I'm in. I think that would be good. And what we would love to see is for all of you to share the pictures of your core sample with us. You can tag us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. We are at KidSolve. Or you can leave us a comment on our website, which is solveitforkids.com. I want to see how many different types of flavors you put into your cupcake and whether or not they're all in the core, right?
And don't forget what Dr. Uli said about after you take your cores, you got to cut that cupcake in half and then make a comparison. I can't wait to see what you guys do for core samples. And then we will see you next time on
Solve It for Kids.